Howdy, partners. This is Sarah Nash as your host, and you're listening to Radio Namaste on Body, Mind, Spirit Radio, bringing you enlightenment, the blue-collar goddess way. Remember to hit me up on our Twitter, at Radio Namaste, with hashtag bluecollargoddess. You'll get the opportunity to be in the drawing for a free one-hour Skype session. And in about 30 seconds, Zen Master Ted is going to introduce our guest today, Vito Mucci. Vito Mucci is a shaman who develops healing modalities and specializes in the psychology of consciousness. His main professional focus is creation of a society that embraces the expansion of consciousness for a greater shared experience and heightened harmony of expression in the world. Much of that is highlighted in his really groundbreaking book, Coffee for Consciousness 101. And by the way, if you want a copy of your own, you can win one in our CFC 101 Twitter contest by tweeting the hashtag CFC101 to our Twitter. Again, that's at Radio Namaste. And remember that Namaste is spelled with an H, and it's more than just a word. Consciousness is a popular buzzword these days, but do people really understand what it truly entails in a functional sense? I mean, often it falls loosely in the same category as love. That is, people have a sense of what love is, and they understand love, the feeling, while overlooking the reality that love is a constant and ongoing action and commitment. It's a lifestyle. So it seems with consciousness. I mean, people seem to operate from an assumption that because now they understand and get what consciousness is, you know, they had their aha moment, they're somehow conscious. Like they're vaccinated. Not against it, but for it. You know, awakened perhaps, but I mean, as far as I'm concerned, consciousness has to be an ongoing action and commitment as well, rather than just a thing or an ideal we can somehow have. What do you think, Zen Master Ted?
And Zen Master Ted says what he really likes about Vito is the fact that this approaches consciousness from a functional perspective instead of being stuck out in woo-woo land with generic terms that nobody really knows what means, but we've all heard them before. Instead, this takes far more of a connect A to B approach, which, at least for some of us, is a preferable way of approaching consciousness. You know, how do you actually do this rather than here is a concept while you sit on a cloud and meditate for 47 minutes?
I want to sit on a cloud and meditate for 47 minutes and achieve consciousness.
Well, I want to do that too, but I'm also cognizant of the fact that that generally isn't how things work.
Well, Vito, what say you?
I think that you guys are exactly right. I think, you know, growing up in a therapeutic household, my mom was a therapist and we had all kinds of books on consciousness around, everything from Eric Fromm in the 50s and 60s to Alan Watts and Carlos Castaneda. And, you know, I really, it really always came back to my mom saying to me, yeah, but you got to do the work. And then I realized that, you know, no one really said what the work was. And so, a lot of the abstraction that I found as I came, you know, further and further into the fields of psychology and philosophy, I started watching the behavior of the people who were writing. So instead of reading, you know, Descartes, which I did, I read Descartes, I actually looked at what Descartes did when he was writing. Like he wrote out the Meditations, I think, therefore I am. And he came out with, in the end, he came out with a very interesting conclusion that's very specific. And basically, I was like, he set down these meditations, made rules for himself, and then ended up proving everything that he had believed prior to. Like, wow, that's a very interesting coincidence. So let me see how he did that. How do you get to make that mistake as you're trying to think yourself into an abstract reality? And I realized that you can't get abstract. So when he said, I think, therefore I am, he didn't define the term I. And I think that's a huge issue just to start off everybody. What is this I? It's not an identity. It's something that's built over a long period of time that we get to observe if we're lucky. And I think that the observation of this I is the first step to parenting not just our children, of course, but ourselves and the people closest to us, and then in the end, the world. And that's what I really want, is to find ways to observe who we are and what we want, and then to be able to foster growth toward that without trying to control anything, because that just doesn't work.
Well, it's beautiful that you're saying this, because this is the conversation that Zen Master Ted and I were having this morning. We were talking about how it is so imperative to show your work. Recently, I have had a friend who fell in love with someone via the internet, which is very common these days, because energy, frequency, and vibration, they actually transmute, I believe, through internet connections.
That's how I found Claudia.
Well, exactly. And, you know, Zen Master Ted and I reconnected, finding each other on the internet, after, you know, I met him when I was 8 years old, and we spent a very, very short and quick weekend together. And then we hadn't seen each other, and he actually found me, simply, I believe, through energy, frequency, and vibration. My
sure.
picture was not on my blog. In fact, my blog was called Misfit, and he recognized my writing, but nevertheless, I got this little message in 2003 that said, "Is this you?" So energy, frequency, and vibration aside, what we have is this inability to show our work, or a resistance maybe, because my two friends who fell in love, and I believe it was genuine, they just ran to the center of the labyrinth and they didn't do the walk. And
right.
these are metaphors, essentially. But I sat up for a really long time last night, because it ended very poorly over a period of 5 days when they finally connected face to face. And they just they thought they would sit in the midst of this bliss, I believe, which is possible. I'm not going to say that it's not possible. But what they didn't do was they didn't spend enough time learning what each other's radioactive dust bunnies are. That's what Zen
yeah.
Master Ted and I call our trigger points. And you know, the consciousness vocabulary, things like processing, triggers.
Right.
I don't know, Vito, you come up with some. Tell us some.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I love is conscious validation, where you observe the multitude of things passing through the external mind, which is my name for the, you know, the constant rambling of things that we come up with to justify or do whatever, and really watch that with another person so that they get to see what's going on within us and how we deal with that. And that's a real area. Like, that's where someone can gain trust with me. Like, it's not that I don't personally trust people. I just tend to see more of their process than I see them dealing with. And I think that's a really important aspect, because there's a ton of the process, ton of things that are motivating us that we're not engaging in it at all, much less in a healthy manner.
Well, let's talk about showing our work. Let's talk about sure. that, and then how we can, because, you know, our parents, let's go back to the parenting thing and then showing
okay.
our work. Our parents tell us, don't do this, don't do that. Dylan, we don't put our transformers in the microwave. And you know, quite often we end up with don't do as I do as I say. And
right.
I think it's really remarkable that you went back and you said, okay, what is this person doing as they're telling me about consciousness, as they're telling the world, revealing this consciousness, I think, therefore I am, and then going back and taking a look at the work behind it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about how we are crappy parents, because we tell each other what we should do, what we ought to do, and then we don't do it ourselves.
Right. And I think, you know, the idea of setting an example has always, like, just that cliche statement, oh, set the example. It's always been there. But when nobody does it, we don't realize that it's an impossible to reach energy signature. We can't copy it, because we can't recognize it when we're doing it. And that's a huge issue. Like, being patient, forgiving, those aren't just words or decisions we make. Those are actually states of being. And if you haven't been around somebody who is actively doing that, you simply cannot recognize when you're doing it or when you're not.
So how do we find really good examples, Vito?
I think all of us have an opportunity to look for gifted moments in our lives, and either people that we come across in those moments, or movies, media, anything that makes us feel a certain way. But the grounding thing, and I think these are two things that I wrote down for today was observing, and just the idea that we're not going to control anything. We're not going to try to control. Parenting is not about control. When I try to parent myself, the first thing I do is observe. I see what I'm doing. I see what I want. I see what decisions I've made in the past and what I would like my life to be in the future. And I think that the observing is the first step. And if we can observe ourselves, then we're much more likely to imprint a feeling when we get something right or when we get something wrong. Or when we see other people getting things right or wrong. I think that's one of the biggest things.
Well, then we run into that age-old dilemma of you're judging me. You're judging me. Don't judge me. You don't know who I am.
I know. I love that one. The coolest thing is we judge every second of the day. It's in the mind. You can't stop it. We can change the way we value a human being. Like, instead of judging upper or lower, better or worse, and creating a narrative in our mind about that, that's unhealthy. But honestly, I judge everything I see all day. It is part of the mind. It is an animal thing that we do for survival, to create, you know, an identity for us within a social narrative that we can't get out of mentally. I think the idea that, you know, judge, don't judge, like, don't be a jerk. Like, that's the cool thing. Hey, you know what? My mind sometimes judges in a way that makes me a jerk. And I'm like, okay, well, I probably don't need to say it like that in my head to myself. And again, that's an observation thing. I think if we observe ourselves, we see that we're constantly judging all the time. And if we don't observe and don't recognize that, then we can't form a relationship with the way that we're making judgments. And I think that's a huge deal, because saying that we don't judge is dismissing a process of the social human mind that is not going to go away. It's just going to hide.
Well, and then there's the intuitive judgment too. I'm not going to go down that dark alley. I'm not going to have a conversation with this person because, I mean, and so after our observations based on prior experience, or perhaps what we've
intuitive.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm sorry. What did you say?
Oh, I was saying the subconscious is speaking to us through instinct. Like, that's one of our greatest assets, is allowing that connection and fostering that relationship.
And the interesting thing about that too, is that there are quite a few people out in the world, 7 billion of them. There are so many people that I truly enjoy having conversations with. I don't want to be friends with them though. Right. And this is something that's happening to me. My ability to discern who it is that I want to spend quality time with, as opposed to just have an interesting conversation with. Like, I would absolutely love to have tea with Hitler. I would not want to be his friend.
Right. Yeah.
But I don't know that. See, I've actually never met the guy, but, you know, history says, hey, this guy was kind of a jerk. You know, he made some bad and poor judgments, but, you know, it's like, then
issues with anger transference that may have led to some issues.
I love Eddie Izzard. You know, it's like Hitler's there painting all the, you know, trees, and it's like, oh, I can't get the leaves right. Kill the Jews. You know,
it's
you know, it's really funny how we can take humor. Ha ha. Funny. Ha ha. Ironic how we can take humor and we can put it into a situation and suddenly it becomes okay. And it becomes palpable. It becomes we're able to look at our flaws and our imperfections.
Well, so, it's a perspective where observation becomes possible because it's depressurized.
And this is where the application of perspective to reality, which is the subtitle of your incredible book, by the way, is so important too, because a lot of people look at Coffee for Consciousness 101 and yet the subtitle is really, I think, the main meat of it is the application of perspective to reality. And this is where people tend to shy away, because Vito, you get real.
Yeah.
You get real. I have two friends that I truly enjoy and like, and neither one of them, and they're both men, by the way, they do not like you. And they know that this is a line that they don't get to cross with me. It's right. Like, you know, I discuss quite often, by the way, passages within your book about, you know, the application of perspective to reality. And as a result of their observations, which I think are flawed. See, let's talk about flawed observations. No, see, I have had this experience. Let's just use your book, for example. I have had an experience with you. I've watched you for several years on the online, as my mother calls it, the online. And my experience has only been incredibly valid, genuine, authentic growth and meaning. And I've been able to apply so many things that you've said in my life. And yet I look at these other people and they, they find flaws. They find flaws in what I think is absolute concrete truth.
Well, and I think this is something, this grows out of something we were talking about the other day, which is, I think a lot of people approach consciousness as this thing, a concept, something that you can have. And at least from where I'm sitting, consciousness is a choice. It's a lifestyle. It's action. It's not an abstract thing. You know, if I have this, then I'm conscious. It is a constant, ongoing set of actions you take that make up something that we describe as consciousness. But it's not like enlightenment. You can't have enlightenment, or you can't.
I have enlightenment. I have enlightenment right here.
Okay. Well, that's true. Let's turn it on.
I see it as we are constantly auditioning to be present in the moment.
Oh, I love that.
I love that.
It's like a consistent opportunity we have to show up for ourselves.
Can we say that one more time? We are constantly auditioning to be present in the moment.
Yes.
That is brilliant. You're brilliant. I want to eat your brain.
Well, thank you.
The zombie apocalypse, I would find you first. Run, Vito, run. But people judge, Vito. They judge. They judge you. And absolutely. Some of the conversations that I've had with people who claim to know you, I think are flawed.
Well, you know, I think one of the things, again, with observation and parenting, especially because I know there are a certain amount of people who don't like me so much, and that's fine. We were usually friends first, and I usually tapped a chord. And the idea is that when I'm parenting them as a friend, I'm looking at their emotional reactivity and seeing that they're filtering logic through that. So, like, let's just say somebody's an angry person, and their matrix, whatever's going into their mind, is there to justify and rationalize that anger. So they'll cherry pick the things that I say or do. And in so doing, everything in the world becomes evidence to support the narrative of their emotional reactivity. And if they were really observing their own emotional reactivity, they'd be able to parent themselves probably a little bit better. And, you know, that's their job. It's not my job to do it for them. And, you know, I only give everybody an opportunity for that. But like, if I'm angry, that's the first thing I see. It's like, oh, that's a red flag. I need to, first thing, stop taking information in through that. And secondly, stop any behavior that sources from that emotion, or else I'm going to hurt people. It's just going to happen. And, you know, it still does get past me sometime. I'm not perfect. But, like, that's the idea, is that observation for self-parenting, seeing the emotion that we're engaging the entirety of our world with.
You know, there have been so many things that you've said in the last 2 minutes that I'm Zen Master Ted handed me a pen and a piece of paper, and I'm like trying to scramble. And then suddenly I realized that I wasn't listening anymore. And see, therein is another key. Therein is another key. We don't listen to each other. We hear something and we focus on it exactly as you said. You know, we cherry pick the ripe and beautiful cherries, or we cherry pick the rotten core. And again, you know, there's that observation. It's It's finding the flaws. And how do we manage to understand this about ourselves? I mean, when I was studying Buddhism, I had this moment, my teacher would said to me once that he had to look at his wife and he would say, a rising of irritation with wife. You know, and in our previous conversation, Vito, we said, you know, those of us, we wander around with like maybe 20% consciousness during the day. And if we have a 50% consciousness day, wow.
That's, you know, awesome.
Right?
Awesome.
So what I'm having here then is we have truly, and I believe this, and I'm just not trying to pander to your ego, but this book, Coffee for Consciousness, is literally one of the finest pieces of work with regard to obtaining and showing your work and learning how to be in the moment. It is a textbook. But so I want to bring it a little bit more personal to you though, Vito,
please.
Because now people are going to start cherry picking every single flaw you have.
I'm totally excited about it.
Are you really?
Yeah, it took me, I did an album when I was 21 and I sent it out to, you know, a bunch of radio stations and I got back a lot of positive things, and man, did I get back some negative things. So I've experienced it before with something that hits close to home, but I think the real safety I have is, you know, I wrote chapter 4, the I'm happy chapter.
Yeah.
I wrote that very specifically. I didn't put anything in this book that I didn't do. I'm really happy. I love my life. I am, you know, a husband first and a father second. And, you know, a healer, helper, writer, that's a really distant third. And so, like, what I'm doing right now, we're having a great conversation. And thank you for pandering to my ego. That's really delicious. But I'm really thinking also about the fajitas I'm going to have in a couple hours and like what my boys' day at school was like. I'm doing that simultaneously because that's where my heart is, because that's where my joy is. And so I don't know what people are going to tear apart with the book that I can't just say, okay, keep an open mind to it. Like, because if you're not happy in 5 years, you may want to reconsider your position. Because I got to happy by doing the things that are in this book.
Right. Right. So this is your work and you've shown it. Now, what about people who want to cherry pick? It's like the Bible. Okay. Honestly, Vito, Coffee for Consciousness has become my new Bible.
No,
and now cool. I'm kind of using it in a woo-woo sort of way. It's
this, the nice thing is you can't really abstract out of it. It's going to pull you back in. And I really wrote it like that.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm doing. I have some of my clients when they come in and I sit down. Every once in a while, I'm now using your book as an oracle. I will open it, just open it randomly. And I'll look down and then I'll verify and validate with, you know, my set of particular oracles. You know, I'm like, oh my goodness. Okay. So this is what's crossing that. For example, if, in my numbers game, when I do readings for people, you know, 1 through 10 shows me somebody who's on their path, 11 through 20 shows me somebody who's made a slight deviation. And then, you know, 21 through 30 is somebody really just needs to sit down. And so when I, and reassess. So instead of using my crossing cards now, what I use to find out what the restrictions might be, I'm opening Coffee for Consciousness. And, you know, I some people may crucify me for this and say, well, it's all, you know, it's all, what is the word I'm looking for, Zen Master Ted? It's all pertinent. It's all applicable.
It's all relevant.
It's all relevant. But it turns out every single time, now I've done this about 5 times since I've been back from Denmark, because I read your book in June, and now I think I need another one. by the way, we are giving away a copy of Coffee for Consciousness as a like a sweepstakes prize. What people need to do is hashtag CFC101 at Radio Namaste. So we want to make sure that people hashtag CFC101 at Radio Namaste. Did I say at 101? CFC101.
CFC101 hashtag.
Yeah, we want to hashtag that. And, you know, why you want the book to at Radio Namaste, just one word, 2 words, whatever, You know, I want to be conscious. I want to be enlightened. I want to find all the flaws in Vito's arguments. Whatever you want to do, go ahead, bring it on, because we will be giving away a signed copy and Vito will send it to you. We're going to stop for just a moment and give a shout out to our sponsors, Alchemy Stones, and a heads up to the Good Karma Factory.
Radio Namaste is brought to you in part by Alchemy Stones. Alchemy Stones are completely hand-painted peach stones that combine the blend of art, sacred geometry, and metaphysics, making them not only healing tools and personal talismans, but also unique gifts for almost any occasion. What makes Alchemy Stones so special? Humans have been collecting and keeping rocks for luck as talismans and mystical power objects for millennia. They've also been painting and decorating on stone for almost as long. The intricate patterns and colors in Alchemy Stones are inspired by nature, sacred geometry, and tribal designs, and are carefully matched to the shape and size of each beach-gathered stone to create a beautiful high-vibration work of art. But don't take my word for it. To learn more about Alchemy Stones and to choose your own personal stone, visit our website at www.alchemystone.com. Alchemy Stones, a unique high consciousness gift for any occasion. Again, visit us at www.alchemystone.com.
Radio Namaste will occasionally present what we like to call the Father Mulcahy Award to those who have displayed thoughtlessness, a lack of mindfulness, or just downright selfishness. With the official Karma Violation Ticket Book, you can let friends, family, coworkers, even celebrities and politicians know they did a no-no. Just fill out a citation, slip it under a door, slap it on a windshield, or mail it. Express your feelings and opinions and help set the record straight. Join the Karma Police at thegoodkarmafactory.com and uphold the laws of the universe. Hashtag Karma Police in a tweet to @RadioNamaste and you'll be in a drawing to win your own Karma Violation Ticket Book. Thanks to the awesome people at thegoodkarmafactory.com. You are a pioneer of the real age, and we need more of you. And sadly, I don't think there are enough of you out there. So
I'm pretty hopeful from the things I've seen recently.
Like what?
You know, I think there's just a higher level of clarity with what's coming through the collective as far as terms. I saw multiple posts that were edging more towards psychological determinism and engaging and presence and, you know, the idea of a shared co-created reality. I've just seen a lot more of that very specifically in the last 2 months and 2 weeks. And as we're heading into, you know, Saturn's going into Sagittarius, which is, you know, kind of like clarity, if I understand it correctly. I'm not a super astrology guy, but I really like clarity. And coming into an area where Bernie Sanders is going to be running for president, and we're dealing with climate change, and, you know, there's a UN summit next week on climate change that could really change the game for everybody. And, you know, it's common sense. Most of the stuff that we're dealing with is common sense. And the idea of understanding emotional reactivity and processing emotions, that'll help us get into our body, because we're just not there. We're not in our body because we can't observe what's kicking us out.
Is this why you had a real huge focus on food for a while? I mean, you still do, don't I? But I remember, and I said this in the last show too, it's like for several months, we would eat what you said to eat, right? Because we were feeling it too. Is that about being in the body?
That's about being in the body and creating a relationship with the way your body speaks to you. So instead of controlling my body and saying, I'm going to eat this today because this is what I have in the house and this is what I can afford and this is blah, blah, blah. The first thing to do is stop and say, hey, what's my body want?
Champagne and caviar. You know,
decide if it's feasible afterwards. There were times when I wanted like lobster and I'm like, well, I can't afford that right now. I'm going to have a sandwich. But like, you know, I needed to know what my body wanted, and creating that relationship and validating it daily, it really gets us it gives us tangible ways of dealing with an abstract concept with observation. I think observation is the most important thing. The easiest thing to do it with is hunger.
Mm. Well, and, you know, sometimes they say that you feel hungry because you're dehydrated. And, right. you know, again, I'm using these as metaphors too. But when we look at a child and we say, you know, put on a jacket, I'm cold.
Right.
You know, I want to go back to the parenting part of it because I think that this is supremely important now,
yeah.
Especially in this day and age, because there are so many people, I believe, who are waking up. They've stopped hitting the snooze button on their consciousness alarm. Okay.
Right.
And they're wiping their eyes and they're going, wow, what do I do next? And,
yeah.
you know, unfortunately, I believe, and my experience has been that there are a lot of very glamorous, a lot of very seductive.
Shiny.
You know, all you have to do is chant to Ganesha, Om Shri Ganesha, you know, for 5 days in a row, and boom, you'll manifest whatever it is that you need. You'll remove the obstacles in your life. And
here's your spiritual bypass machine so that you don't have to process anything now that you're awake and things hurt. Yes.
Right. And enlightenment, I'm sorry, it sucks.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, the more enlightened I become, the more I want to turn the lights off because I see more shadows and more cockroaches in the corner and more dust bunnies. And not only that, being an enlightened person, you know, when I walk into, and yeah, that was arrogance, but I'm owning it, man. I feel like I am becoming enlightened because I notice that when I walk into, what?
Confident, I think, is the thing.
Thank you. I believe I'm going to own that. And it is becoming more and more confident in my abilities to be a bringer of the light, because I'm understanding also that when you walk into a room and you are enlightened, again, this is a metaphor, but people scream at you because suddenly now it's very bright and now they have to like clean, they have to get out the dust,
yeah.
you know, they have to get out the brooms and the vacuum cleaners and they have to do, you know, this metaphysical house cleaning and they're
in a panic.
Absolutely. Because nobody wants to look at their dirt.
No. So we got a parent. And we have to allow ourselves to be parented by ourselves and others. That's the, my mom read me the Plato's Allegory of the Cave when I was 9. And, you know, I live my life knowing that when you bring the light back in, they're going to attack you.
Oh,
that's
gosh.
What happens. You go outside, you find the light, you bring it back in, and you get jumped.
Absolutely. Because what is this thing? It's dangerous. We have to kill it.
Right.
You know, and it's if you see the Buddha on the road, shoot him.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting that you talk about your 9-year-old, because recently I have been dealing with, a very, very difficult period in my life as a 9-year-old. And
right.
where I, the odd thing about this, though, is that my 9-year-old is really okay. That child who was raped and abandoned and misused and harmed in so many horrific ways, when I look at her, she's really okay. And the odd thing about it is that I wasn't okay with her being okay.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
and when I came back and I had to realize that it's me who needed to grieve, how do you explain that?
Right. The internalization of our own reality. There are things that we've externalized throughout our lives, and we got to see that in order to observe it, we have to, you know, we don't have to control it. We have to allow ourselves to feel it. And we can't will ourselves to feel it. We can't control when we're going to feel it. But there's a state of allowance that lets us really observe our emotional reality as it is in consistent reaction over an issue or whatever happened. I have issues that I work with every, like it may be every 2 years. It may be, I may not have it for 6 years. And who knows, it may show up a decade from now. But it knows if it needs to get to me, if there's something in my past that needs to speak up, it knows I'm going to listen. And that's where we get the confidence.
Well, it's interesting that you should say that, because this morning, as I was doing some of my meditations, I suddenly was struck with this fear, this absolute, it was this incredibly grounding, huge fear. It was a tsunami of fear.
Terror.
That, oh my God, I'm going, what if this happens again? because, you know, I was foolish enough to think that I'd worked through many of my issues.
Right.
And I had this moment, literally, I was sitting cross-legged in front of my White Light Express altar thinking, oh my God, what if I'm going to get hurt again and again and again by, you know, my past resurfacing and coming up? And I thought, okay, well, my inner 9-year-old is okay, but I'm not. And you know what, right. Vito, for the first time in my life, I have given myself permission to say, I am not okay.
Oh, that's so awesome. You know, the book, I'm Okay, You're Okay.
Yes.
When I was like 17, I was talking to my mom about it. I'm like, Isn't it supposed to be like, I'm effed up, you're effed up?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's like, I'm not okay and you suck.
Well, yeah, it's like, you know, we're all not okay. And that is okay. But we can't say that it's okay, because then we think it is okay and it's not. We're really not okay. None of us are okay.
Well, if it's a paradox, it must be true. With that. Yeah, if it's a paradox, it must be true. And I'm sorry,
right.
I don't mean to talk over you. I truly don't. But I have a note here. I have a note here because you turned me on. I was actually stalking you online, by the way. You turned me on to this movie that we watched the other night called How I Live My Life Now.
Oh, yeah.
And it is an incredible film. And I have to tell you, it was very realistic. But there's this moment, okay, we're talking about parenting our inner 9-year-olds,
right.
or our inner 9-year-olds parenting us, actually. And, mm-hmm. You know, it's odd, but there's this scene in the movie where it's after they've escaped, and I don't want to give too much of it away because I really want people to watch this movie. It's one of the greatest love stories I've ever seen, by the way.
Really
too.
Was beautiful, yeah.
And the protagonist of the film, the girl, she's walking through the forest with her little cousin, who's about 9 or 10. And they've been walking and walking and walking. I mean, they're dehydrated. They don't have any water. Her feet, the little girl's feet are bloody and, you know, just, but anyways, I had this moment and I'm going to cry here for a second, but anyways, where she turns around, the older girl turns around to the young girl because the little girl's complaining. I'm tired. I'm thirsty. I'm this, I'm that. It was this whole litany of complaining. Right. But it was just, and she was absolutely valid in doing it too, because, you know, it sucked. But the girl turns around and she starts screaming at her. I'm going to leave you here. I'm going to leave you here in the middle of the forest and bad things are going to happen to you and blah, blah, blah. And I had this memory, because I'm going through this, of my mother doing the same thing to me. She's turned around. She's screaming at me, you know, in this horrific moment in my life. And like that little girl, I was watching the little girl in the movie. She just got really quiet. And she's looking at the older girl screaming at her. And all I could see on the little, and they filmed it beautifully, by the way, was just utter compassion and resignation to just, okay, I need to shut up because this older person here is suffering.
Right.
And I think that if more of us have those moments, and Zen Master Ted, he's brilliant at this. And I'm going to give him a high five for this, because I have these moments where I turn around and I just unload on him. I say some of the most vile things, you know, it's like, I can see, and he has this compassion on his face where he knows that I must
perspective shift into a parenting role on command.
And I think if more of us have that, but how do we find compassion when somebody is standing there screaming at us that they're going to leave us and they're going to leave us in the forest and bad things are going to happen to us? And yet here we've been traveling with them on this journey. Our feet are bloody too. We're thirsty too. And I was looking at this child and I thought, that was me at 9. I was right. able to dump all of the hell that I was experiencing because my mother was in pain too.
Right. Right.
How do we do that?
I think we try it. I think we wait for it to happen and we try it. And the only way to make sure that happens is that we get excited about it when we think about it. Like the opportunity to step into a parenting role, or the opportunity to experience pain without hurting somebody else, or from a different perspective than just our own pain. There's always something bigger than our own pain. And there's always a larger view where we can see that. No matter what pain I've been in my entire life, I know that that pain has made me stronger. So automatically, every pain that I have from here on out, there's definitely a bigger perspective. I know that from my history. And I think that as soon as we step into a parenting role once, when we're being yelled at, when life isn't, when things are really not going our way, not just a little bit like, oh, no, like when we're in terror, horror, fear, and face to face with something that is creating frustration and animosity within us, to be able to step out of that into a larger perspective, thing is, it feels so good that it really imprints the first time you do it. And I think just having that on the burner, and for those of us that have already started to do it in one spot or another, I think that's how it spreads. Because the thing is, it's contagious. And you only have to really do it once to learn how delicious it is.
So the next time that guy cuts you off in traffic, wave at him. Smile or not.
Yeah.
The next time your wife or your husband is coming in and they're screaming at, you know, the fact that you've done XYZ again for the 100th time, just
yep.
stand there and love them.
Yep.
That takes a lot of guts, man. And sometimes, wouldn't you say, Vito, people are looking for a fight?
I say most of the time people are looking for a fight because we just carry around a lot of held anger and resentment. We do. And, you know, we have the opportunity to unload. We're usually looking for targets. And the only thing I know is that it feels so good to not do that, to step into a different role consciously, that I have a lot of faith that we're going to see a lot of changes in how people process those moments and the amount of consciousness and presence that we can bring through our body into those situations that allow for growth for everybody. And that's what, you know, parenting is.
Well, in your book and in the chapter Psychological Determinism,
mm-hmm.
you talk about the absence of the possibility of free will as it's,
right.
it's a tough pill to swallow. And I have this outlined,
yes,
by the way. And you say, why is it hard to accept that the sum of our experiences plus our genetic disposition combine to make our decisions for us? Why must there be so much dissonance over our lack of control? The angst of no promises, where unavailable certainty is concerned, turns into the fury of no control, where illusory freedom is concerned. So we actually, you know, you're sitting there saying, oh, it feels so good to, you know, a lot of people call that, oh, well, he's, you know, that's arrogance and that's ego, because you're, now you're just like the bigger person because you're not fighting back, you know, and so there's that filter on it.
That could be there. I just don't feel like that.
No, you don't.
This is a great example, and this is one I love. So when we're dealing with free will, right?
Right.
So if you have free will, you can make any decision you want at any time. Now, we all know that that's limited by knowledge and this and that, but let's just say we still have that. That is like having only open note tests on subjects that you understand in school. So you, at any point, no matter what question I get asked in my psychology class, I have the question and answer in my notes. And that's cool. But what it creates is a world where we don't have to study, investigate, or observe, or allow.
Oh.
We never have to look through our notes if we have them for the test. And the truth is, the tests are always pop quizzes. They have nothing to do with our notes.
That
good.
Is so true.
That is good.
Wow, that is an amazing Oh, I love that.
Analogies are the best ways to teach, I swear. It's
oh.
just so fun.
Well,
and creative.
Absolutely. What I face, though, as an HSP, a highly sensitive person, I tend to work with a lot of other HSPs who are actually very literal. And it's odd because when I look at my past and I can see how I was raised and how I fell into movies and books as a means to survive.
Yeah.
So when I'm looking and working with other highly sensitive people, they often tend to take my metaphors as very literal. So I always have to put out it, it for me, it causes an additional layer of frustration sometimes, because very intelligent people will use my metaphors and they'll you know, there was a, I had in a, an experience once with an alien entity. It was literally an off-world life form. Mm-hmm. And I was explaining to him that I needed to get my ducks in a row. And it was sort of like a channeling message, and there's a long history behind it. But the funny thing about it is that this very intelligent alien life form, it was interdimensional. I was driving, it was in Ohio. I was driving home and I literally saw him standing out in the middle of a field. And I wish like heck I'd had my cell phone with me at the time, because it was one of those times where you're like, I got to get a picture of this. I got to get a picture of this. And I didn't have it. I'd actually just left my house and to go make a quick run. And I came back and he was standing out in the middle of the field and all of the geese were in a row. and he was like this. Like, is this what you meant?
Is this what you meant?
And you know, it's like, well, yes and no. But dealing with analogies and metaphors too, you know, it's like the child, some of us have inner 9-year-olds that are very entitled and like to throw temper tantrums, which takes me to the portion of your book about body sovereignty.
Yeah.
And the raccoon trap.
Ooh, one of my favorites.
Yeah. So that I want to go, that is literally one of my favorite metaphors and analogies in your book, the raccoon trap. And I think it's really important because we're talking about people who are getting angry and we're parenting each other. Let's talk about the raccoon trap.
The thing that's mostly in there is resentment in general. So do you want me to describe it real fast?
Absolutely. Please do.
Okay. So, one of the ways you catch raccoons, if you're trying to catch them in the South, and I got this from, you know, old, I think it was like Where the Red Fern Grows or something like that. You make like a wooden container, and then you put spikes that are facing downward, and you put a ball bearing at the bottom. The ball bearing is shiny. Raccoons love shiny things. So the raccoon will come by and he'll stick his arm in it for the ball bearing, and he won't be able to get his arm out. But it's only because he won't let go of the ball bearing. So he'll just sit there holding the ball bearing, not realizing that he's completely untethered.
Yeah.
Because he identifies so much with the object at the bottom of this, you know, little container.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the human body's the container, and it can fill up with all kinds of stuff that we want to attach to, that we think is us. Like, my anger's not me. My resentment's not me. My fear isn't me. That's something that happens with this brain that helps it survive. Now, the things that I create when I'm joyous, I think those are probably a little bit more me because I'm building things. There's a huge difference between destroying things and building them. And, you know, any mind can react and destroy and attach to fear. But one that builds is very different. And so the raccoon trap is the objectification of reactivity that should be de-identified with. So this is my fear. This is my pain. This is my anger. This is my resentment. It is not me. And it is something that I can let go of and just walk away from.
That's brilliant.
Of course, it's a little bit more like it's not like you can just decide to let go, but that's the real relationship. The real relationship is that anger, fear, those aren't us. It's not who we are. Those are things that happen to every human inside their brain.
Well, I'm actually
response like soreness or inflammation or flu.
Well, and then further on in the chapter, the portion of the book with regard to body sovereignty, you know, what we do to process this stuff quickly and efficiently, what do? We let go. It says right here, you know, we need not to clench up with fear and we need not to freak out when it happens. Don't clench.
Yeah, because that's what they do. Their hand slaps down on the ball when they believe they're trapped.
Or our resentment and our emotional
reactivity is so strong that we stay in it.
And it's not even just being trapped, though. You know, I think we trap ourselves. And I'm thinking about certain people in my life that they'll hold on to something. And it's literally their justification for being a jerk.
Right.
And so
justify it, yeah.
And what do you do when 19 parents come along and say, hey, listen, little jerk boy, little jerk girl, you need to let go of that. And, you know, now suddenly you're not even dealing with a 9-year-old. I'm trying to take candy away from a baby. You know, some people are very, very attached to their pain.
Absolutely.
And so as a good parent, though, what do we do? I feel such compassion for parents when they're in the market and that kid goes off.
Yeah.
That kid goes, yeah. Now suddenly the banana or the cookie or the toy or whatever it is, the most important thing in the world. And they got 3 more things to get in the store. And that kid is letting everybody know in the store how freaking tired he is. And, you know, it's absolutely amazing to watch people around it. There's some people who look at the mother and the child with compassion. And, you know, honestly, I'm kind of a jerk. Because I've raised my kids. Now I've got, so I find myself, depending on how well fed I am and how tired I am and how well I've had my day, either looking at this woman with compassion or disgust.
Right.
So, you know, there's that 50% consciousness again, where I'm like, yeah, stepping back going, oh my God, I feel so sorry for that woman. And other times I'm like, what the hell is she doing? She's so selfish. She's making all of us miserable by, you know, bringing her tired little child into the store. What the hell? You know, we don't know what happened in her life. We don't know if she's been at the hospital with her sick husband or sick mother or whatever, and this is her only opportunity to go to the store. I mean, everybody has a story.
Yep.
I think we need to listen to each other's stories more.
I think so too. That's the observation part of parenting. There's always a reason. And that's another thing with psychological determinism. It's always, they're always doing the best they can in the moment. Everybody is. I am. And I, you know, I'm lucky in that I look at my own life and some of the truly horrible mistakes I've made. And I know, like, okay, I was doing the best I could there. And there's still shame and guilt and anger and frustration, but my ability to manage and recognize all of those different parts of myself and the type of relationship I've formed with those responses just makes it so I don't clench up and I don't get stuck in a raccoon trap.
Well, and then just in, you know, we're coming into the end of the show here, Vito, but, you know, let's talk for just a moment about shame.
Yeah.
Because I think that's really a very, 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 very essential part of poor parenting. You know, when we shame our children, you know, it's you could have done better, or you could have done this, or you could have done that, or why did you do that? Or, you know, and it's the shame thing. It's bad dog, bad child. You know,
you did this, you are bad. Yes.
Yeah. Or why did you do this? Why didn't you, you know, what's wrong with you?
Right.
You know, it's my daughter who pointed out to me at one point some years ago, she said, if you ask me one more time, what's wrong with me, I'm going to hand you a list. And I'm going to tell you how each one of these things is your fault. Everything I've learned about life, I've learned from my daughter. So, but how do we prevent each other from shaming each other?
I think, I think besides the fact that psychological determinism frees us from shame, like it becomes a vestigial part of our psychology, because that concept is probably a bit far off still as far as, you know, social acceptance.
Right.
It's just
it is. That's a shame.
We start really setting an example to shift perspectives from one where we are blaming people to one where we are rehabilitating them.
So it's
the same thing with jail. Are you punishing somebody by putting them in jail, or are you aiming to rehabilitate them? And I think this is a way that we can all just kind of ask ourselves how we feel about the world. Are you trying to punish somebody, or are you trying to rehabilitate them? And if you're in the punishment section, which a lot of us are, even the aware ones, much of the time, then we can manage our own anger transference and held anger with that and consciously shift to the rehabilitation side. we're rehabilitating self, then we're dealing with shame. If we're rehabilitating others, then we're dealing with relieving blame. And those are that's the way to do it, is really shift from punishment as a justifiable response to anything. Really? Is that, I mean, and I'm saying that, and it sounds like a punishment when I say it, because I'm still so stunned that it's such a large part of our society that punishment is seen as some kind of justice, like as if a punishment ever did anything positive for anybody ever. It just didn't. And the only goal is to rehabilitate if a mistake was made.
And so rehabilitation, though.
Chapter 22.
Yeah. Chapter 22, rehabilitation. The rehabilitation part, though, is I think this is where we start getting, again, we have the basic building blocks of the human psyche and human nature. But I know for a fact that I have clients that I'm not capable of working with anymore, simply because they choose to hold on to their pain and do not want to be. They choose instead to make their illness their hobby. You know, right. There are literally so many people that I know who are just so excited when they're sick.
They choose power over happiness. You can control your illness. You can stay ill as long as you want. Illness is a certainty if you want to be in it. And that power versus risking happiness is oftentimes a much safer, more attractive, seductive answer.
And I am so down with that. I was just explaining to somebody why curses work and why, you know, breaking spells work. And this is, again, a metaphor. But this woman literally came to me literally many times.
Literally, really sharply
to the left. She sat down in front of me and she said, "I believe I've been cursed." And I said, "I believe that you're right." Because she believed it. And as a result of that, I'm going to go ahead and validate that the power of negative focused intention is laser fast. It is so streamlined. Anger and resentment and all of those things that carry that vibration of a pointed end. And so I explained to her, I said, so imagine you've got two weapons here. Okay. The force, right? It's the force. Luke, the force.
It literally is the force. Don't underestimate the power of the dark side, but it is not stronger.
It is not stronger, because what happens is that it gets that one blast. You know, you get to shoot that 22 and it's a long straight bullet and it hits and it makes a little hole and boom. You know, yeah. Or you can shoot out a bunch of light, which is like the rock salt inside of a rifle, mm-hmm. and you chalk it out and it scatters all over the place. And you know what? It lasts a long time.
Yeah.
And I tell people, you know, I'm like the power of positive focused intention versus the power of negative focused intention. Both of them are very real and very effective, but the
one
power
is tougher to build.
Exactly. And there's more work in that. The universe expects to see your work. And so this is why, you know, as parenting, I think what we can do is really assist others with their rehabilitation by showing them how to look at their own work. And then discernment comes in. You cannot parent someone who refuses to show you their work.
Right. That's true.
You've shown us your work, sir. This Coffee for Consciousness, the application, the Coffee for Consciousness 101, the application of perspective to reality is an incredible beginning, middle, and end to this process here. I can't wait to see what you do next, but I think you deserve a break. I think you need some time to just soak this up and, you know, create the workbooks and the workshops. What do you have what do you have in the works?
My next book, I'm just gathering, chapters that'll be for relationships, because we're not ready for it yet. I mean, you know, not, I'm not saying that in a bad way. It's just, we have to realize that processing emotion is a huge thing before we can even start to process emotion with another person. Otherwise, that's like taking 500 grenades into, you know, an oven and expecting to get out okay.
Talk about an analogy. I just thought, kaboom.
Yeah, it's just, you know, then until we can manage and observe our own reactivity, we're going to be causing a lot of conflict when we deal with other people. And that's, you know, okay, but I don't want to give it to anybody until there's enough of a bedrock lane with the Coffee for Consciousness to be able to refer back to it confidently so that, you know, there are no injuries.
So Vito, I noticed that you have some videos on your page. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. I realized that Coffee for Consciousness has a 20-page glossary, and each one of those terms deserves a couple minutes of explanation, a couple minutes of real-life explanation, so that we can see how they work in our lives rather than just in an abstract universe. So those are going to be in the photo section of the Vito Mucci page, and they should be accessible and shareable to anybody.
That's perfect. Thanks, Vito. And hey, how do people get in touch with you?
I don't know. How do you get in touch with me? I think it's really Facebook is my, anybody can message me on Facebook. You can message the Coffee for Consciousness page too. I get messages there. But in general, I'll answer anything or talk about anything given enough time. So you guys can get me on there still right now before I get overwhelmed. Right now, I'm not overwhelmed yet.
Well, I like that every once in a while you're out there. You ask me anything.
Yeah, I love doing that because it stretches me. I dig it because sometimes they ask me things that have nothing to do with anything I wrote in the book, and they're. And it's in real time. I dig that. I like to answer questions in real time.
And that's true shamanistic work. That, you know, being able to be that oracle and to be present. Hey Vito, thanks so much for being on Radio Namaste, and I look forward to having you on again.
Thank you.